Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to Homemade Business 101. My name is Isaiah. I have the pleasure of introducing the host. You know him. He's everybody's hero, my best friend. Will you please join me in welcoming my granddaddy, Baba Jahi?
Wow. Always a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much, Isaiah. Always a pleasure and an honor to have you to be able to introduce this show, Home-Based Business 101, here on Blog Talk Radio, just truly listener-supported radio. Hey, we'd like to thank the 23,940 people that have listened to a show here on Home-Based Business 101, helping make us the number one home-based business radio show here on Blog Talk Radio. And, hey, we're just so thankful for all of those listeners that chime in and listen to programs that we have here on this network. And we're just really thankful of you, and we appreciate you. In today's show, you know, we got a very important topic we're going to discuss today, and we have a special guest who's no stranger to this program. Today's topic is called The Fourth Principle of Kwanzaa, Ujamaa, Cooperative Economics, Can and how to make it a reality. Can we make it a reality? And if so, how do we make it a reality? And we have with us today none other than Mr. George Sabira. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest speaker before bringing him on and dialoguing around this topic as it relates to black economic development. George Sabira has a 45-year career in community activism, education, writing, and business. The community activism began in the 1960s and continued in the 70s in both Los Angeles, California, and Newark, New Jersey. He is one of the few individuals still alive who was present at the very first Kwanzaa celebration. That's one of the reasons we wanted him on here today, in December of 1966, and was the coordinator for the very first public Kwanzaa program in 1967. He's earned a BA degree in history from California State University in Los Angeles and two graduate degrees from Rutgers Graduate School of Education. He's also attended Rutgers Law School for 1 year. Also during the 70s, he was a black studies instructor at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. In 1980, Sabira became an independent writer, speaker, and businessman. He published a book entitled Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, and some of you listeners might remember we had him on here to discuss that book. This book was the first book of its kind and started a whole movement of self-help, money, and motivation books directed to the black community that we see today. As a result of his books, Sabira received plenty of national and publicity with appearances on the Phil Donahue Show, the Today Show, Tony Brown's Journal, the 700 Club, and coverage in Essence Magazine, Black Enterprise, Jet, and Ebony Magazines. At least 100 local radio programs and newspapers ran stories and interviews on Mr. Sabira as a result of the many years of cross-country travel. He has spoken at about 40 colleges and a dozen of black conferences and conventions, including one in Alaska. In 1988, Sabira published the first and only sales training book, Getting Black Folks to Sell, that has ever been written, especially for the African-American community. The total sales of Sabira's books are about 125,000 copies. In 1997, Sabira became a founding member of Mata Network, a black company that distributes black products nationwide through a network marketing process. He had 1,700 members. Sabira was one of the largest organizations in Mata. And in 2002, Sabira was selected by the East Coast Expansion Coordinator for Compro Tax, the nation's largest African-American-owned tax preparation company. And since 2002, he has been a significant factor in helping open up about 20 new tax offices in 7 states. His latest project is the founding of the Compro Tax Business Mentoring Program. It is designed to introduce young African Americans to the world of business and financial literacy. He has mentioned the different publications he has: Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, Black Folks' Guide to Business Success, Black Folks' Guide to Selling, Money Issues in Black Male-Female Relationships, and then he has an unpublished manuscript called Kwanzaa in the Black Economy, And so you can see he's really been out there, getting information.
Conference recording started.
Getting information out concerning black folks around economics, money issues. And so, you know, it's really a privilege and an honor to have Mr. Sabir on here with us today. Good morning, George. How you doing?
Good morning, brother. How you doing? I'm very happy to be back with you again, and I look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here, and, it's really, I know you have a very, very busy schedule, and we appreciate you coming. And today's broadcast, people, for those of you that might have questions, the chat room is open. You can post your questions in the chat room. We'll not be taking questions over the phone line so that we can stay on point and stay on topic. But, it's no problem if you have a question, just post it in the chat room, and, we will get to your question. So, Brother George, let's go back here. 1966, was there when Kwanzaa was introduced, and then 67, you was responsible for the first public Kwanzaa program. Take us back to that, if you may, and walk us through what that process was like and what was the projected outcome, even though we know at that time Kwanzaa was initially an organizational holiday, eventually went on to become a movement holiday, and now it's a national holiday celebrated by people outside of the range of just organization and movement. So would you walk us through that, please?
Well, the organization really got going as far as growth in 1966. You had in 1965 Watts Rebellion in August of 65, and Maulana Karenga and several people in the Watts community formed the organization in the fall after that, and then I came on board probably in 66. And by the fall of 67, to be quite honest, we felt it was important to have something that was an alternative to Christmas. We were building a cultural organization, and even though today, in 2010, if you listen to all the presentations, they'll say that Kwanzaa is not a substitute for Christmas, that there's no conflict or no problem between celebrating Christmas and Kwanzaa together. That was certainly not the case in the very beginning. So we had a need to have something that was an alternative to Christmas. And also for young people, a number of people in the organization had kids, and the program was designed to give them an alternative, something to understand, to appreciate from a cultural point of view that did not have, a lot of the aspects of Christmas as part of it. So that's how, that's how it began in 66. I, quite honestly, and a couple of people who were my closest friends in the organization, we didn't really look at it as a big thing. It was just a house party because it did take place in somebody's house, and it had African aspect to it and an African American aspect to it. And by that I mean we had African folk tales, and we had drumming and dancing and that kind of thing. And then later on, when they put the music on, it was regular, Motown music and party dancing. And, the thing let out at about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. At that time, we looked at the Karamu, which is on the last day, the 31st of December. It was such a new thing. We didn't really consider the whole 7 days as part of Kwanzaa. I mean, technically and formally, Maulana probably laid it out, but we weren't used to multi-days as a holiday. Every holiday in America was a one-day holiday. So we really looked at the 31st of December at the Karamu as really Kwanzaa, as opposed to the preceding 6 days. So that's how I remember it. Maybe if I got into a conversation with other people that were there with me, it would remind me of maybe things were different than what it is I just laid out. But as I remember it, that's how it went down. The second Kwanzaa, 1967, now that was significantly different for a number of reasons. First of all, there was a seven couples were getting married on that night. And so we were planning as much for a wedding as we were for a karamo. Again, Kwanzaa did not have that much of a status within the organization, so the fact that I was part of that did not have any particular, how should I say it? It wasn't necessarily an ego-boosting kind of a task. It was just something that, you know, needed to be done that night. What was important was that a lot of significant community leaders and politicians was going to be invited to the event, because by that time, the US organization was about almost a year and a half old. Actually, yeah, about 2 years old, really. And a number of public programs we had been a part of. Maulana Karenga had been in the news on several instances. And so people were curious, what is this organization? Who is this leader? What are they about? And so that Kwanzaa sort of was like a door opening to say, come in, we're having an open house for you to check us out so you can see, you know, how we do things, what it is we're trying to promote here. And so in that sense, it was an important Kwanzaa, because it was the first time people outside of the organization was going to be exposed to the concept. And my job at that point was simply to find out who wanted what done and how we were going to get it done as far as decorations and timing and scheduling and that kind of thing. It was like being an event planner, really. And it went off pretty much without a hitch. And that was pretty much that. There's nothing immediately that I can add to that I can think of right at this point.
Okay. And now, since that time, you know, we have seen over the years how Kwanzaa has grown and how a lot of people have adopted, you know, the seven principles that was the, you know, the foundation of the organization, us. You know, I got exposed to the seven principles coming home from Vietnam in 1971, and was in California before heading out, and was a bookstore called the Ujamaa Bookstore, where I first got exposed to the concepts. And later on, when I got out of the military and moved back to the East Coast, I got involved in what was called the Congress of African People in a CAP formation, which was, you know, practicing the philosophy of Kawa Ida that Dr. Maulana Karenga had put together in the organization. And, you know, since then we have seen numerous programs that people have adopted around each one of the principles, from Umoja all the way to Imani. And, you know, the basis of our heart and basis of what we really want to dive into today is the principle that people have seen to have the hardest time developing some type of programs around is the principle number four, Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own store shops and other businesses and to profit from them together. You know, and people have tried to merge that concept around some things in terms of black economic development and how do we deal with social wealth and communal concepts of wealth and all of that. When you reflect back and then take us forward, when you reflect back on the principles, what, from your perspective, what was the organization's intent to see what was supposed to happen or be developed from this fourth principle?
Well, very few people, let me be careful on how I word this. Most people did not really feel comfortable in volunteering ideas in the US organization. If they did volunteer the ideas, they may have volunteered the ideas to someone who was looked at as a senior person in the organization other than Maulana Karanga. The way the organization worked, Karanga would more or less tell the organization what they would be doing and explain it. So it wasn't like it was blind allegiance, although there was a certain amount of that. But there would be an explanation as to why a certain direction would be taken. And 90% of the time, it made a lot of sense, and it was just kind of a natural flow. So when you say, what was the organization's attempt, the organization seldom spoke as a united body. The organization more or less reacted and implemented and fulfilled the ideas that Karanga himself put forth. And any kind of problems that anybody would have with whatever would be put forth were sort of handled behind the scenes. So everything was new, and nobody really felt comfortable that they could come up with an alternative with as strong a rationalization their alternative as whatever Karanga put forth. I'm not trying to confuse the listeners, but it was like, okay, if you object to something, then don't just object for the idea of being objectionable. Come up with an alternative and explain your alternative, why you think it's better than what has already been put forth. So if something was empty, it more or less remained empty. And in the case of Ujamaa, Karanga put together some nice wordings of what Ujamaa was supposed to stand for, but there was no implementation of what the wording stood for. We did not say, okay, as an organization, we're going to develop stores, we're going to develop a food co-op, we're going to develop any of that. And there wasn't, to be honest with you, there wasn't any significant pressure at all put on us to specifically patronize black businesses at that time. Black businesses, to be honest with you, if you remember, that by 1968, Richard Nixon was getting ready to enter the White House, and Richard Nixon was the guy that put together this idea of black capitalism, that America is going to support the idea of black capitalism. And so when you put those two words together, that was like oil and water. And so any person in business pretty much was, whether they deserved it or not, was put under that black capitalist title. And they weren't necessarily looked at as heroes or people to aspire to be. So they were sort of slandered by this term of being black capitalists. And so I'm saying all that to say that we weren't really pushed to patronize black businesses. As a matter of fact, sometimes Karanga would say that black business people was sort of using black people to get rich, and they didn't really have any consciousness in terms of giving back to the community, which in a lot of instances was absolutely true. But we sort of, you know, threw out the baby with the dirty bathwater. There weren't many exemplary businesses that were pointed out to us in Los Angeles where somebody say, okay, make sure you patronize this person or that person. There were a couple of black lawyers because we had a number of brothers who were, you know, picked up so-called legitimately or illegitimately. And so we had to constantly pay lawyers to get people out of jail. So there was a steady support there. But as far as particular people who sold clothes or who sold food or who sold cars or who sold any of the, you know, the necessities of life, we were never directed, as I recall, to support, you know, any particular black establishment.
Okay, you talk about Nixon and also that era. I remember there was this thing that I believe Floyd McKissick was involved with, this concept that they was, I think it was right here in North Carolina, was supposed to develop something called Soul City. Were you familiar with that project?
I remember the wording, Soul City. I do remember Floyd McKissick being with it. I thought it may have been in Mississippi, but maybe North Carolina was the state. I don't remember. I know I read about it because I read about everything that was going on in the movement, but there were so many different tangents and directions and leaders that you kind of, you know, forgot at this point, you know, the specifics.
I know he was Nixon's person for, you know, I sort of remember vaguely him being the person that Nixon, with that black capitalism piece of, you know, pushing Floyd McKissick in the Soul City concept.
Yeah, well, like I said, I do remember the man and the concept. I do not remember the specifics of what it was trying to accomplish. And I don't remember exactly where his support was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly wasn't an NAACP type of program. It wasn't an integrationist concept, as I recall. But at the same time, I'm not sure if it was a nationalist concept either. So rather than to try to, you know, make a statement about something I'm not sure about.
Right.
Or just have to say I don't really remember.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking about that in terms of the context, and you was talking about how, you know, I remember the whole, you know, black capitalist push and how, you know, people came out and I remember Boggs, he wrote an article in his in one of his books about how it was, you know, a ridiculous concept. I remember Fiery Earl Hutchison, you know, doing a thing on the myth of black capitalism. So as you were saying, then business sort of had it like a dirty name or dirty thing in the black community, especially what this whole idea of push around the concept of, you know, capitalism being evil, bad, and we needed socialism, but no one could come up with, you know, what was going to be a transitional program. And then I remember there was some people that said, well, Ujamaa was supposed to be the transitional, you know, plan to get from the evils of capitalism to the utopia of socialism. And, you know, as we look at that, what type of, you know, beyond the organization, what type of movement or direction did you see people taking in terms of black economic development, and what were the strengths in that? What were some of the pitfalls?
Well, first of all, I have to mention that there was a book that highly influenced the nationalist community, particularly as it related to economics, and that was a book by Eric Williams, who was from the Caribbean. Something in capitalism. I can't remember.
Capitalism and Slavery.
Yeah, Capitalism and Slavery. And that book was sort of almost like a mini Bible other than the autobiography of Malcolm X, people talked about that book a lot. And that book did its job, which was completely show the relationship between the exploitation of black people and us being used as a commodity and the buildup of the entire capitalist system. And because of that, anybody that was a nationalist, so forth, they just had little tolerance to look at any kind of adaptation of business here in America. It had to be revolutionized. It had to be totally torn down and rebuilt into something else, whether that be communalism, which was Karanga's word, because he didn't want people to think that people didn't think of sharing before white theorists in Europe came up with the concept of socialism. He wanted everybody to know that the African community had the concept of communalism, which was, you know, way preceded socialism, way before that. So, but again, these were words. These were words that were good in books. These were words that were good in lectures. These are words, but as far as how are you going to pay your rent, how are you going to make sure your car is working, how are you going to get to the meeting, pay your gas, I mean, we had to survive in the America that we were living in. And what was happening at that time was you had a lot of the Lyndon B. Johnson poverty program money that was, you know, I don't know if Model Cities was before that or after that. I think it maybe was after that. But the bottom line is the Great Society programs, as it was called, that President Johnson had sort of started in conjunction with the passage of the civil rights bills that were done under his watch. A lot of nationalist thinking people thought of that as getting our money back from the man. In other words, the white man owes us, and he's paying us back in the form of these programs. So we are going to make sure that we get jobs in these various agencies and get him to give us our money that's due to us while we do community work. And so that was about as close to a form of community-focused economics as most of the nationalist community got to.
Okay. And with those, you know, those people, you know, bought in to those programs, did any kind of, you know, in your opinion, did any kind of real sustainable community development come out of it? In other words, if, you know, people extracted money from the system, did anybody build anything with it, or was it just another job?
Well, you had a couple of things. I think that a lot of community organizations, really solid organizations, came into existence that truly looked at the needs of the residents, may have gotten started in that era. And then later on, when that federal money was faded out, a lot of these organizations were able to sustain themselves by applying for grants from foundations and corporations and became sort of institutions in the community, organizations that people could depend on, and did a lot of good, helped a lot of people, helped them with job skills, helped them to get ready for college, helped them make the transition from being a offender in jail to an ex-offender, maybe able to get a decent job. So that's one thing that I think happened. Secondly, a lot of your political leaders came up through that kind of system. You know, people like Maxine Waters, who maybe started off as a teacher, social worker, got involved in these community-type organizations and tussled with the city or maybe a local council person about, you know, fighting for this or fighting for that, and began to understand how politics worked with the city, and then later on actually ran for office as an alternative choice for a city council person, alderman, county executive, and eventually, you know, state representatives representing that whole area in the state legislature, a state congressperson, and then some of them eventually into the federal system. Here in Philadelphia, we have a long-standing member of the House of Representatives named Shaka Fatah. And Shaka Fatah's parents had a kind of a had a home for delinquent boys, delinquent black men, where they took 5, 6, 7 houses in a block, city block here in Philadelphia, and began to work with young kids who had problems with their parents, problems in the legal system, problems in school, and work with them in such a way that they became an institution. I'm not sure who funded them, but they've been around a very long time. And through that process, he became a local figure. The son of the couple who started the process, he became an advocate, and now he's been in Congress here in Philadelphia for at least the last 16 to 20 years, I believe, and has a substantial position right now in Congress. So what I'm saying in summary is that through all that poverty program money, you had ambitious, strong-willed, sincere, serious people who did try to do as much as they could with the program and built significant community organizations that in a lot of cases survived after the government funding dropped out. And then some of those same people became political leaders that ended up being mayors, black mayors of cities, black council persons in cities, state and federal Congress people in those from their experience in that situation. And even when you look at President Obama, I mean, when you go back to his grassroots, you know, after he finished Harvard Law with all these flying colors, he elected to be a community organizer. And then from that community organizing base, you know, went up the political ladder to the point where, you know, he's now president.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to take a station break here. And come right back at you. Hey, you're listening to Home-Based Business 101 here on Blog Talk Radio. This is truly listener-supported radio, and we want to thank the 23,940 people that have listened to a show here on Home-Based Business 101. Today, our topic is the fourth principle of Kwanzaa Ujamaa, cooperative economics. Can and how to make it a reality. Can we make cooperative economics a reality? And we're talking with our guest today, Mr. George Sabir, who has a background in terms of a community activist, an educator, and also a businessman. Come back to Mr. Sabir. Okay, so George, you know, you're talking about, you know, people extracting and stuff from the system and then using it to do things in the community and all of that. So let's dwell into this concept of black economic development, which is tossed around a lot. You know, people talk about, you know, well, you know, this program is a, you know, a black economic development program that we have here. What's your take on, you know, one, the concept of black economic development, and what have, you know, you've seen in terms of the, you know, the panorama of approaches and what has worked or hasn't worked? Or I mean, I know Tony Brown had his Freedom Program, Nation of Islam had its Power Program, and then you were real big in Mata, and I mean, I'm pretty sure there were some other programs out here that have attempted to deal with this concept of black economic development, because as you said earlier here in the broadcast, is that, you know, those of us that's involved in community activist work to do good in the community and all of those things, we still got rent to pay, we still got, you know, if we're going to get around, a car note, buy food, there's, you know, some economic things happening in our lives, but we sort of have a disconnect to economics in terms of a program in our community that can sort of help us navigate our way through that, in which there's some ownership around that economic development piece. So what's your take on black economic development?
Well, I have a lot of perspectives, and so I might be sort of long-winded with this, but I want to
go ahead, take your time.
Some of them out. First of all, let's look at Black History Month, and you might say, well, what does Black History Month have to do with any of this? When you look at Black History Month, you ask yourself, who are the people that we constantly parade in front of our young people to say, look, this guy or this lady is a hero, and you should note what they have accomplished, and maybe, if at all possible, you know, think about doing something similar as you go down your road in life. And we bring out, you know, the Jackie Robinsons and the Jesse Owens in athletics, and we talk about, you know, George Washington Carver, the scientist, and we talk about all these different kinds of people, including black military people, who some people might say, well, you shouldn't have been in the war anyway because that wasn't our war, and you came back to America and he still treated you like doo-doo, so you were a fool, not a military hero. I mean, I know some people who take that perspective. So they line up all these people that you should salute. Well, if you were to look at that list really clear, you will find that consistently, they never mention black business people as somebody that you should study, admire, except for one person. One person emerges over and over again, and that's Madam C.J. Walker. And the reason I believe that they talk about Madam C.J. Walker was, number one, so many times when we talk about heroes, we leave out the women. And so she's an easy person to include when you want to say, well, we need to have some women in there, so let's put Madam C.J. Walker in there. And also we know that she was very wealthy. It's been said she was the first black person to have earned $1 million. So she was a millionaire. So the fact that she was a millionaire and the fact that she was a woman makes her an automatic inclusion in that list. But you take her out of the mix and you see black people commemorating or celebrating no black business person whatsoever, which is kind of ridiculous because we've had some significant black business heroes that just aren't mentioned, you know. Even if you look at modern day, you know, when people think of Motown, they think of the music, you know, they think of Smokey Robinson, they think of Marvin the Vandellas and so forth. They don't really give much credit to Berry Gordy, who had to negotiate the development of a company through a system run by white lawyers and Italian mafia types that changed the world of music all over the world. It has been said, and I can't document it, but if you know anything about Motown, if you look back and say from 1960 to 1980, that 20-year period, it's been said that Berry Gordy has been responsible for the development of 500 black millionaires, that 500 separate and distinct black people had $1 million pass through their hands as a result of their connection with Motown, whether they be as a singer, as a songwriter, arranger, a lawyer, all the various jobs that people do, they had $1 million pass through their hand. Now, that is an incredible accomplishment.
Yes,
absolutely mind-boggling accomplishment. And you could sit down for the next 5 days and not think of another black person who's ever done anything like that. But is he mentioned as somebody that we should, you know, emulate from the standpoint of business, and we should champion that and look for the next person that can develop? I mean, how much cooperative economics is that if you can share money to the extent that 500 other people became millionaires? Now, on the other side of the coin, there's people who say, well, Berry Gordy cheated black people out of their money. I mean, Gladys Knight had to file suit, and Mary Wells had to file suit, and the Osley brothers had to file suit. Look at all these black folks that filed suit against Berry Gordy and Motown because they felt they were cheated out of their money. Well, unless you're there and know the specific details, you don't really know who got cheated out of what. We know for sure that white people cheated black people out of money. We know that. But what we don't have is a previous example of a black person building a company and making sure that these literally thousands of black people got a shot to do their dream and make money that they could not have made or would not have made had they just tried to latch on with another white company, a lot of them. So what I'm saying is, historically, we have not made any effort to champion the accomplishments of black businessmen, and that's telling the current generation that either A, we have not achieved enough in that area worth talking about, which is wrong, or that's not an area that we want to focus on, which is also wrong. So that message, you know, whether it be conscious or subconscious or unconscious, I never did get all those words exactly straight. You know, that message is sent. Now, when we look at progress, we always measure progress seemingly as our level of unemployment as compared to white people. So they say, oh, it's 6% unemployment among whites, but it's 12% unemployment among blacks. And from the last 50 years, we've had this comparison of employment, which is a measurement of jobs. And jobs is the foundation. Jobs is extremely important. But why is it that at the same time that we're measuring jobs, we don't measure the growth of business? You know, we should have quarterly or biannually or annually, we should have a measure of the rate at which black businesses are growing. Now, unfortunately, the federal government, they take stock of the development of businesses, but number one, we're dependent on an entity that's outside of our community. I tell people black people should at least be experts on themselves, meaning we know more about us than anybody else knows about us. But unfortunately, with all the PhDs and all the statistics out on black people, we depend on white people and white organizations and white surveys to tell us about ourselves, how many of us there are in a particular town, how much we make, what we buy. I mean, we depend on the other people to tell us about ourselves. I mean, that's crazy when you look at a group that is as educated as we are and so-called determined to be free. We should know. We should have a way of measuring the growth of business or the decline of business and watch it like we're watching a football game. If you were to watch any kind of sport and you didn't know who the players are and you didn't know how much time was left in the game and you didn't know what the score was, you'd walk out the stadium because there's no way to hold your interest if you don't know nothing about what's going on. And that's what's happening in the black community. You have a lot of activity going on, but nobody is documenting the successes and the failures, the progress and the retrenchment. And so people just lose interest and not pay attention to any of it. So if we took as much effort in measuring the growth and development of business and saying, okay, through this quarter or through this six-month period or through this year, we had a 0.5% or 1% growth in black business in the state of Pennsylvania, in the state of North Carolina, nationally, whatever the case may be, then it would be put into the consciousness of our people, and they would know that that was something that they should pay attention to, because we're constantly looking over the records to see, what's happening in that area. I remember when I first came out with my first book, Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America, and naturally I was trying to get as much exposure for the book as I could. And, of course, one of the first places I went was Black Enterprise Magazine. Could you take this book? Could you give it a review? And could you, could you kind of get the information out there that this book exists, that they should go to bookstores and ask for it, blah, blah, blah. Now, this was 1980, okay? This was 1980. Black Enterprise came out in 1970. So I hit Black Enterprise 10 years after they were already out there. Okay, they had, 120 issues, 120 different issues had already been printed before I came on the scene. And what I found out in 1980 was that up until that time, you could not walk into any store and buy Black Enterprise magazine. You had to be a subscriber. Why? Because it wasn't available on the newsstand. It wasn't distributed. So even though they had over 100,000 or maybe even 150,000 subscribers to the magazine, the black community, it was felt, was not supportive enough of the business magazine for them to say, okay, we're going to put it on the stands and trust that people will walk up to the stand, see it, recognize it, value it, and buy it. And I was told that I was very lucky that I had caught them at a time where they had just completed their first deal with a national distributor and that they were going to be made available at newsstands nationwide. Now, in that discussion, it came out that they were going to have 20,000 copies on the newsstands, okay? Now, that's a small number. When you consider that in 1980, there were at least maybe 30 million black people as opposed to the 40 million that there is today. Out of 30 million black people in America in 1980, certainly 25 million, that they only felt comfortable in putting 20,000 copies of the magazine out. Now, Black Enterprise is the only black business magazine that there is, I mean, as far as a national publication. So, again, that shows a lack of interest on the part of black people in reading about, studying about black business. And when you go to the same newsstand, you'll find that there's three or four different magazines just dealing with black women's hair, okay? That there's four different magazines that you can buy that has nothing but black hairstyles in them. So look at a people where a company is comfortable enough to put four different magazines out there talking just about black women's hairstyles, okay? And yet the only black business publication could not survive on the newsstand for the first 10 years of its existence. And I'm going to make one more point, and then I'm going to stop. About 20 years ago, 25 years ago, Ebony Magazine brought out its 100 Most Influential Blacks. and you went down the line to see, okay, who did Ebony Magazine, which has this, you know, this national vision of black people, who do they think are the 100 most important black people in America? And year after year after year after year, Earl Graves was the only significant black business person, other than John Johnson himself, you know, representing Ebony, and also the people at Essence Magazine representing Essence. But as far as business information or the business world, Earl Graves was the only business person listed. Okay, you had people who headed up the sororities, the fraternities, you had some union people, you had all different kinds of people, but of the 100 most influential blacks, you had virtually nobody from the business community that Ebony felt was significant enough to say, okay, this is one of our most important people that we need to listen to give our community direction. So, again, when I go back and I say, you know, look at all the other factors that preceded our dealing with the concept of Ujamaa. Look at the black cultural environment in which business was placed in a very, very small corner of the room. And that's the environment into which the nationalist community had to fit in the concept of Ujamaa.
Okay, you pointed out some, you know, brought out some very good factors and points there. Let's look at some of the attempts that people have taken on from a network marketing kind of concept or something, you know, close and similar to that. I mean, you know, I think people like George Haseley, who was, you know, was in Amway, and then Joe Dudley, what he did, and other people sort of gave some food for thought. And then we saw Tony Brown. What was Tony Brown's program? Freedom? Was it?
I forgot the exact name.
Yeah, but Tony Brown had a program. Nation of Islam attempted a program that was go beyond, you know, the Bing Pies. I remember one time he was doing Bing Pies and the Fish, and then they came out with this power program. And then the most recent, unless there's something else that has come out, was that I remember was Mata. What's your take on some of the black network marketing approaches to this concept of economic development in Ujamaa?
Well, I'm going to come back to that, but I want to talk about two other people.
Go ahead.
That I think definitely affected black people's opinion about black business people. One of the things that Madam C.J. Walker was known for was, number one, she did a lot of advertising with the black press. So she made sure her name and her product's name was out there by reinvesting a lot of her money with the black press all over the country. And she gave a lot to community organizations. So that people knew that when they bought Madam C.J. Walker's product, that they were also supporting maybe the YWCA or something like that in their particular town, because she would give money to those, you know, charitable type organizations. So when you do that, that creates goodwill toward the business person, because you know that they're just not taking all the money and spending it on themselves. Two men kind of gave the black business image a bad name in a lot of people's eyes. I mean, they were fantastic individuals. They were incredible individuals. I mean, you look at their stories and you say, how the heck did they do that? But at the same time, as you marvel at their accomplishments, you hear what words are coming out of their mouth, and you say to yourself, we don't want to support that person. And those two individuals are S.B. Fuller from Chicago and A.J. Gaston from Birmingham. Now, S.B. Fuller probably, S.B. Fuller predated Amway. He created products for black people's hair and skin and put them in a little box, a little almost a case, and you went door to door selling your Fuller products in the city of Chicago, in the city of Detroit, in the city of Philadelphia, New York. So he had a national sales team that was comprised of hundreds, if not thousands, of people selling his products door to door. And from that, he leveraged the income from that to create his own laboratories where he created the products to create an empire, really. He had he owned a block of real estate in Chicago where they had the movies, they had warehouses. He owned a lot of real assets that was beyond just the selling of the care products, okay? What he did, however, that turned some people off was he discounted the importance of the protest movement. He discounted the effort that should be put into efforts of engaging, you know, white folks in battles about discrimination. And basically what he said was, if you put as much effort into doing your own thing, into building up your business, and leave the white man alone, you would make a whole lot more progress. And that was a turnoff. That was a turnoff, and a lot of people felt that, you know, he was not supportive of the movement, when actually the further they made progress in the movement, the better it would be for his own business, because he would have that much more rights and latitude to do things to grow as a businessman. So, as a matter of fact, one of the things that contributed to the demise of S.B. Fuller was the fact that the establishment, the black leadership establishment, actually called for a boycott of his products. And they said, you know, we want you to not buy this black man's products because his words is harmful to the movement, and we don't need to build up somebody that's going to turn around and hurt us and keep us from helping the common man in the street who doesn't happen to be a businessman, who happens to be just looking for a job so he can earn a salary and support his family. So that was a thing that rippled, that had a rippling effect across, certainly in the city of Chicago, but across the United States. And A.J. Gaston, it wasn't quite as bad as that. A.J. Gaston started out as a steel worker, steel mine worker, and he eventually got himself in a position where he owned a black bank in Birmingham. He owned a black hotel in Birmingham. He owned a black funeral parlor in Birmingham. He owned a black radio station in Birmingham. And he owned a black insurance company in Birmingham. So he was a super-duper multi-millionaire guy. And he, too, made sure that he kept his relationship with the white establishment of Birmingham on the up and up, even during the times that the bombings in Birmingham were going on and other horrible things going on against black people. He served black people, but he made sure that he didn't cross the wrong white people in the town. And what he did was, he was sort of like a secret finance man. He would give money Dr. King. He would have let people stay at his hotel and eat in his restaurant and give them time on his radio station. So he would be, he was a back, a behind-the-scenes supporter of the movement, but they could never get him to get the full weight of his financial wherewithal to back the movement completely, because that would have hurt his ability to grow. And so therefore he was cast, he was talked very negatively about in the Birmingham and in the South during that time, sort of not quite as bad, but sort of like how we would look at Thomas, I'm sorry, I'm losing my focus here, the Supreme Court Justice Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some black people may be proud that he's black and on the Supreme Court, but at the same time, the majority of black people who know anything about his politics look at him as like a traitor to black people and are not proud that he is on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And so A.J. Gaston and S.B. Fuller, they sort of cast themselves in that same kind of light. On one hand, we're proud of what you're doing. We know that you're helping a lot of black people. But your relationships with white people and your attitude about what you think black people should be doing is such that we really can't really put you out there as a role model, because we don't know if we'd be better off if we had more of you or not. So I had to get that out there.
Sure.
As part of the historical backdrop, in my opinion, of why it is that, you know, we readily embrace so many other people as heroes, but we have this hesitancy when it comes to, you know, championing black business people.
And it's interesting as you bring that up, which, you know, leads into the other question I had, you know, concerning different people that, in terms of network marketing and aspect, because that is sort of like even in some of the network marketing opportunities, you know, that are multiracial. When I talk with other African Americans, you know, they be like, let's just talk about business. I don't want to talk about, you know, racial issues, because I don't want to turn the white people off that might become a part of my downline. And then I look at them and I say, well, how many white people you have in your downline? And in most cases, you know, not all, but in most cases, people don't hardly have any anyway, because race is still a reality in terms of, you know, things that we do. But, I mean, I have met people who, have told me that you know, they thought, you know, that I might would do better in network marketing if I was to change my name back to the name I had before I changed my name back in 1973. See, 'cause, you know, white people would better listen to me. So you're a good speaker. You can do this. You can do that. But, you know, you into that black thing, and when you know you're not a Christian, you burn candles. I said, well, that's called Kwanzaa, you know, but they don't see that. They call it, you burn candles and other stuff. And even though I don't, and when I'm doing, you know, my network marketing business, I'm talking about product and I'm talking about other things. But people always talk about, you know, I have a black baggage that they say that they feel holds back from, you know, excelling to levels that they think that they can excel at. But I tell a lot of them that's the integrationist fantasies. But anyway, that you know, I wanted to get that in, because what you're saying is that it seems as though it's this precarious deal with being in the world of business as an African American, is that almost like Du Bois and that soul of black folk, those two warring souls, and which way do I go? If I want to make a lot of money, then I shouldn't, you know, do a certain things or be associated with certain things. But if I want to help my people, then, you know, it's sort of like that, like almost like a psychological catch 22.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, again, it goes to the fact that we're still trying to figure this whole thing out. And the thing that I think would help a lot is if we concentrated on what I think is more important than money, which is power. You know, the single thing that bothers me more than anything else as I look at our situation today is that we talk about everything except power. You know, when we talked about black power in the 60s, what we basically meant was the ability to implement Kuchichakalia, to make determinations about what we are going to do because this is what we decided and we have the power to do it. But today, people talk about race relations. I mean, they've always talked about race relations, but today it's all about getting along. Well, as long as you let white people stay in control of most of the important things going on in a society, you know, they won't have much of a problem with getting along with you. But when you want to get to a point where you want to control some decisions, important decisions about things, then that's when they have a problem, and that's when you notice that race becomes a factor. So if we as a people said that the ability to make decisions that's in the highest benefit of our people is more important than anything else, including money, then I think we would be on a better path than if we just said, let's figure out how we as a people can make the most money that we possibly can. Because based on the model that we're being shown, you know, the common man knows, well, the best way to make money is to come up with something that you can sell, go over to China and get them to make it, and come back here and sell it for 4 or 5 times what it costs you to get it made based on the low wages that they pay their people, as opposed to finding good jobs for our people here. So if that was the basis only of making money, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be helping our own people because we couldn't help them get any additional jobs if we were figuring out how to get it done at the lowest possible rate. My brother is in the construction field, and he says, you know, how many black workers do you have on this project or that project? Well, yeah, that might be important for black people, but from a contractor's point of view, he probably wants to know how many Mexicans you have on the project. Because from his point of view, Mexicans work harder, they're better at what they do, and they certainly come in cheaper. And if he can do a multi-million dollar project and save all that money, then he's going to make the most profit. So anyway, it's a constant battle between even figuring out in some people's minds what the highest priority should be. And it makes for a lot of craziness that you see going on out there.
Right, right, yeah. When I was in New Orleans right after Katrina, I remember a friend of mine who was working at a place, and one of the black people complained, you know, and the owner told him, he says, well, if you don't like what's going on, you can quit. He said, because I can hire 2 Mexicans for the price of 1 of you. And,
right.
You know, it was like, you know, we said, that's, you know, that was that. I mean, and the guy was, you know, he was perturbed, but I said, okay, well, you know, he's looking at his bottom line, and, you know, and again, as you say, it gets back to the question of power. You know, how do we position ourselves to have power that we can do the things that we want to do? Hey, we're down to 20 minutes left, and I did want you to, before we go into your project that you're currently doing, if you could take about, you know, about 5 minutes and cover the, because there were some, you know, attempts by black people in terms of this network marketing piece, such as, like I said, Tony Brown had a piece, Nation of Islam had the power products, and then we had Mata. You know, with taking about 5 minutes, what were some of the strengths and some of the weaknesses of those programs, and why you felt that they died out?
Well, there's one person that always gets left out of the discussion of that, and he's a good friend of mine, He doesn't seek a lot of publicity, but I'd like to give credit where credit is due. But way before there was Mata, there was an organization called The Deal, D-E-A-L.
Mm.
And The Deal predated Mata with the same basic concept. It was run by a brother named Lee Green, and he was based out of Washington, D.C. And Lee Green was the point person when the Black Expo used to come to Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Lee Green was the main person that worked with Black Expo officials to make a successful Washington, D.C. Black Expo. And he had a company called The Deal. And The Deal was very similar to Mata in the sense that he would identify Black people that had things for sale, whether it be books or creams, powders, whatever. And you would buy them from The Deal, and then The Deal would then pay X amount of dollars override for what you sold based on the size of the organization that you built. And he ran into a problem that Mata ran into later, which was several. Number one, supply. If a product became popular, and instead of ordering 20, you wanted to order 200, could the person supply it? Or would you have to say that's on back order? And when you ever told a distributor it's on back order, the first thing that distributor would want to know was, well, when will you have it in stock?
Right.
And if you couldn't give them an answer, then that means they couldn't give the person that wanted to buy at retail an answer, and it would just smack of typical, so-called typical Black business and not having your ducks lined up in a row. So that was one problem. Can your suppliers give a consistent quality and consistent numbers as was requested? So that was one problem. Another problem was pricing. You know, Mata was small business, and whenever you had small business, whatever was being manufactured was manufactured on a small scale, and just sheer manufacturing arithmetic said that when you manufacture something on a small scale, it's going to cost you more per item than if you were to get several thousand or 10,000 manufactured at the same time. So none of the people that we were working with manufactured anything in lots of 5 or 10,000. And so therefore the cost per product was high, particularly if there was something to compare it to in a dollar store or a supermarket or any other kind of major store. If you're talking about washing laundry detergent, for example, our laundry detergent, you know, may cost twice as much as what it would cost in a supermarket, and then you would have to turn around and pay shipping to that laundry detergent from the warehouse to wherever you live, which means by the time it got to you, you paid, you know, $12 for something that you could have got in the supermarket for $4. And plus, you still wasn't sure whether what you paid $12 for was even as good as what you would have gotten had you paid $4. So questions about quality, questions about pricing, shipping charges, all those were factors that made it difficult for people to make a strong emotional commitment to the things that Mata was selling. Because, of course, you can't get a strong commitment if you don't have a strong economic base to operate from to begin with. And then, on top of that, you had the pay scale for the compensation for successfully building a distribution organization. I had, like you said in the piece, 1,700 people. Of those 1,700 people, only a small number took the time to actually sell any of the products, and the fact that the company was only paying a 5% override meant that at best you were only going to get, you know, 5 pennies for every dollar that your organization sold. So if your organization sold $1,000 worth of product, which is something that you can feel good about, you know, you're only going to get $50 of that, and you can't do so much with $50. So you'd have to be in the tens of thousands of dollars in order to get a check that you could say, you know, pay a car note with or pay your mortgage with. And we just was not a big enough organization to sell, you know, $10,000, $20,000 worth of product, you know, at that time. So some of these were the problems with Mata, and I'm not saying that, you know, it couldn't have been improved, but the leaders of Mata were not that open to listening to other people's advice. They both had MBA degrees from an Ivy League university, and they had a lot of experience in both network marketing as well as other kinds of business, and it would be difficult for them to really, you know, pay attention to ad hoc suggestions from the field. They thought their decisions they were making were the best to be made, and so the organization went along accordingly. And as some of your listeners might know, one of our main leaders was shot and killed by the Washington, D.C. sniper, and from that point on, the organization took a nosedive, and eventually, for all practical purposes, it's been out of business for a few years now.
Okay. As we're winding down here, you currently have a program that you're doing, and that program is a mentoring program to expose, as you know, as we talked about all of this, you know, young African Americans to the world of business. And I see from description is, you know, the first goal is to open up new categories of income choices and opportunities for each participant, but particularly for the younger ones in their teens and 20s. The second goal is to encourage people who don't want to work for someone else that it is possible for a non-college educated person, even one who may commit it, who may have a criminal record, to make a comfortable livelihood working for themselves. And the third major goal is to have a positive effect on the culture of Black Philadelphia so that more people of the younger generation will focus on owning more businesses, commercial property, and large-scale enterprises. So let's talk about this program you have so the listener can know, you know, how they can support it and what you're doing in that area.
Okay, well, I'm based in a city called East Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, and right outside of Philly. And I'm a manager of one of the Comprotax offices. And what I'm trying to do here is to create a movement, a local movement in the city of Philadelphia, to get young people, and my definition of young is 18 to 30, to think about starting their own business as a way to understand business. I mean, to study business in school is one thing, to actually operate a business where when you make a mistake, it costs you money, and you don't make a mistake, you make money. That's when you really are learning about business.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to start a movement of young people getting involved in business. We're offering them several choices so they're not necessarily shuttled into one thing and one thing only. And from that, we then want them to see the whole notion of diversification. When white people use the word diversity, they talk about spreading their money. When black people use the word diversity, they think in terms of wider areas of America being open to hiring them as workers. So they have two different definitions of what diversity means, and I'd like more black people to understand financial diversity, whereby, you know, some of your money you maybe put it into some funds that can accrue interest over a period of time. Some of the money you might invest in real estate. Some people might look at buying an existing business. I mean, there's a whole industry of people who sell businesses the way real estate people sell houses. But we don't know anything about that. It's not something that you, you know, walk past a storefront and see a sign saying, I sell businesses. So they need to be exposed to that. You know, other people may want to go toward their dream business. You know, we're very clear up front that we're not helping people reach their dream business. We're helping them get the contacts, the money, and the customer base to help them position themselves to get into their dream business. So that's some of the things that we're trying to do, and we're still in the very early stages. There's nothing really significant to report as far as development at this point, but I'm really, really serious about it, and I'm going to make it happen.
Okay. I see you have down here, is this still current, that you have National Motor Club has partnered with you, and is that still current?
Yeah, the National Motor Club is a very good set of services that are provided to people who pay a small amount of money per month. It's long time gotten away from just being a highway emergency help service. They go far beyond that, and that's one of the businesses that we make available to the people who want to come on and join the team. The number one business that we're promoting right now is a business called MPB, and it's a business that allows people to get involved in selling groceries. It's a gentleman in Florida that's want to get into home delivery of groceries, and he's come up with a plan whereby people can actually make money while helping him go toward his goal, which is having hubs around the country that are able to deliver groceries to people's homes. So people can make money in that business. That particular business has a lot of advantages that most network marketing companies do not have. So I'm very excited about promoting that business in particular. And we're also involved with a company called Clear, which allows people to have a wireless internet service. I'm not very active in that particular business right this second as we speak, but I suspect as we get more into the college age youngsters that we will find people that get excited about that kind of thing. And, of course, our foundation and our rock is ComproTax. We are looking for any and all of the people who might be interested in these other businesses to also look at the possibility of being a preparer in ComproTax, and we certainly are going to encourage everybody, and probably will have a contest to have people refer their friends and relatives to come to ComproTax to get their taxes done, so that even if we have few people in a position to become preparers, at least we'll have more clients for the preparers that we do have. And that's something that I expect to see take place this upcoming tax season in 2011.
Okay, okay. I need you to do is give out your contact information so that people can know how to support you, and you know, the website that they go to for the program, and then we'll do a summary real quick.
Okay, well, my name is George Subira. The last name is spelled S like in Sam, U B like in boy, I R A. My telephone number, and that's the way I prefer to be contacted, is by
okay.
phone. It's area code 610-626-2585. That's a day or evening number. You can call me as late as 11 o'clock at night. I don't have any problem with that. My website, the website for the mentoring program is CPT. That's C like in cop, P like in Paul, T like in Toronto, mentoring, cptmentoring.com. There's some information on that site that needs to be taken down. There's some information on that site that needs to be put up. However, the general information stands as true today as it was a year ago when that information was first put on the site. I haven't updated it, but you can get a good idea of where we're going by checking out that site.
I just posted it in the chat room for those that need it. It didn't get it all down, as you were saying. It's posted in the chat room, and those can you can click and go right to it and check it out. Go ahead. What were you about to say, George?
Well, even though it's Philadelphia-centered, I mean, it's clear when somebody looks at that information that I'm focusing on one city, I do welcome people from other cities and other states that want to do at least some of what it is that we're trying to do. I would welcome you to participate. I do think there's potential to spread this movement all across the country, but I think, you know, it would be good to say you have one successful roll of the dice in one town and before you try to say that, you know, we can do this everywhere.
Right.
I do believe, as hard a nut as Philadelphia is to crack, if you can be successful in Philadelphia, you sure can be successful in just about any other city in the United States.
Okay. And what would you like to close out with sharing with our listening audience concerning, again, this concept of Ujamaa and black economic development? Closing comments.
Well, to be very honest with you, I didn't know that I would have as much to talk about as what I ended up talking about. We really didn't get into some of the main things we wanted to get into as far as how could Ujamaa be practiced. I gave so much background information and historical information that I don't think we even got to the main thing, and yet 90 minutes is going away. So,
I already extended us a few more minutes, so, I mean, if you want to talk, if you want to give some practical examples as far as we close out, we got time to cover that.
Well, I think that network marketing is that system of people having the ability to earn their income while at the same time helping other people above and below them earn an income also. I think that business model is very good as a practical way of doing Ujamaa, cooperative economics, because we're talking about people cooperating together, selling a product, and reaping the income that they've earned based on how the system is set up. And, of course, there's a lot of ways to set up the compensation plan. But even beyond that, once a person has developed a personal and business relationship with people and has earned some money, I mean, they could then take that cooperation and do other things, common investments, whether that investment be you know, a piece of real estate to buy, rehab, and sell and split profits, whether that be to put on a special event, whether it be a concert or a lecture, a musical event, a choir concert, anything that, you know, can be looked at as an investment maybe too big for any one person. A collective group could put their money together and do it and then split the profits at the end. So what I'm basically saying is network marketing can be not only the vehicle to implement the concept of cooperative economics, but could also be the jump-off point where other collective efforts can be done as a result of the relationships built in the network marketing operation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm under the same, you know, belief. I mean, I've shared with people, and, you know, sometimes, you know, people you know, tell me, I dare you say that you do network marketing. That's a form of cooperative economics. What I mean, I see it as shared wealth. I mean, and with most decent compensation plans in network marketing, you know, I don't, like with the network marketing company that I'm involved with, I don't make any money unless the people that are part of my team makes any money. So it is, you know, a system of sharing in the in the profits and proceeds together. And I think, you know, you hit on a key point when you said, as you develop those relationships, when it's really, you develop good personal relationships with people, there's so many spinoffs that people can engage in that beyond the initial network marketing company. And I think that's a very, very important point.
Yeah, I remember 25 years ago, I heard about a stairway collapsing in a Holiday Inn hotel in Kansas City or something like that. And I think maybe one or two people got hurt. Well, as it turned out, this hotel was owned by a group of Amway people. And I think George Halsey was one of the owners. George Halsey, of course, is top black person in Amway at the time. I don't know if he is now, but, you know, 25 years ago, we're talking him being the top person. So they went from selling soap to selling hotel rooms at $100 a night. And that's a big jump. But they were only able to do that because of the relationships that they built in Amway. And Amway is just one of many network marketing companies. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have a people who constantly complain about there not being enough jobs, and the jobs are going overseas, and the jobs are being taken over by computers. And at the same time, those same people do not open their minds and open their eyes to other ways of making a living. You know, you can't have it both ways. What you sound like you're saying is that you're insisting that the government or companies create new jobs when you don't have the power to do nothing but bitch and complain.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the reason that that's bad is because you end up taking it out on shooting and killing your brothers and sisters for whatever they happen to have in their handbag as you're running down the street trying to escape the police. So, you know, our people have to be open to other ways of making money. Otherwise, you know, they're just not going to have an easy time surviving in this country. And network marketing is one of those ways.
Okay. Hey, we've been listening to George Sabira this morning, and hey, it's been a great show, a great program, and you know, I really, you know, like for people to heed the information that was shared. And you do still have one book that people can still that you have access to that people can get in. I mean, it's a great book, Getting Black Folks to Sell. We got about another 5 minutes before my time is up here. And so with that book, I mean, some of the things that I got out of it, you know, that helped me, especially in, you know, in dealing with different network marketing companies and stuff, was to come up with some of my own strategies, because usually most of the companies don't have a strategy for dealing with, you know, the African American community. I mean, and in your book, you know, you suggest different ways that people can approach selling from a black perspective. Would you care to endeavor on a couple of those points as we wrap up and talk about the book here for about 3 minutes, and then we can close out for today?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity not only to speak to your audience, but to say so much, because it's very rare that a person gets an hour and a half to discuss anything to the public like this. So I want to thank you, brother, for giving me that opportunity. Relating to Getting Black Folks to Sell, which is the book that I have available for sale right now, you know, our people have a right to be distrustful of salespeople the same way they have a right to be distrustful for teachers, for police, for doctors. I mean, in the white community, these people are held in high esteem. You know, the Joe the friendly cop, Mary the good teacher, and John the friendly doctor. But when you have historical things like the Tuskegee experiment lingering in the back of your mind, and you see cop after cop throw your brothers and sisters against the car and handcuff them and be charged with all kinds of police brutality, we have totally different views of these friendly types. And the same thing in business and sales. We've been exploited as a people by tricky salesmen, you know, saying one thing, bait and switch, giving you something totally different than what he or she promised you. So I don't knock black people for being leery about salespersons and sales in general. Now, the question is, like a knife, are you going to be constantly in fear of a knife because you've seen people get cut, or are you going to grab that knife and learn how to use it for your own purposes? And I take the position that we ought to grab the knife instead of fearing it or distrusting it. We need to learn how to use the knife for our own means and purposes and learn how to use it as the tool that it was meant to be. The fact of the matter is that most people spend all their money. And the fact of the matter is that they don't always know exactly how they should spend their money. And what a salesperson basically does is make a convincing argument to somebody that they should take a part of their money and spend it on what it is that you have to offer. And you have to feel good that what you're offering is valuable, and you have to feel good that it's worth what it is you're asking, and you have to feel good that if they say no, that it's not time to commit suicide. You just come back to them a little later on, and you move on to the next person. And selling is a profession, and we need to give some time in learning how to be a good salesperson, because once you are very good at that and master that, you should have no period of your life when you're completely broke, because there's always something out there that can be sold and you can make some profit from.
Okay, okay. And one last thought. You said something a long time ago that always stuck with me, and that is that business is not a mass movement, and we're so used to mass movements that when we go in business at times, that if we approach it from perspective of mass movement, then we're going to have tremendous frustration because it's not a mass movement activity or entity. You said that a person should, if they can find 5 to 7 key people that they can work with, that they got a chance. But to think that they're going to, like, you know, in the mass movement days, going out recruiting everybody, and think that that's what the model is that you're going to have a lot of frustration.
Well, the statistics say that the majority of all people hold a job. The majority of Jews, the majority of Italians, the majority of people from India, the majority of any people are job holders, which means they're not business people for the most part, and they're not salespeople. So the people who own or run the businesses or sell the products and businesses, they're maybe 10 or 15 or 20% of the population, regardless of what population we're talking about. And so the point I was trying to make is, you know, you can decide to be in that 10 or 15%, or you can be with the majority who work a job. I mean, how many professional basketball players are there? Each one makes at least $1 million, $2 million a year, but there's only 300, 400 professional basketball players in the United States. So that's less than a small part of 1%. So you could strive to be part of that elite group, or you can, you know, be a truck driver where there's thousands of times more truck drivers than there are basketball players. So I'm saying that they can look at sales differently than what they used to. They can look at it as something where they're part of an elite group who get a chance to make more money than the average person once they become good at whatever it is that they do. But it's not a mass movement in the sense that you can expect, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry to see the opportunity as you see it, because it's just not going to work out that way.
Okay. Okay, so true. Hey, man, it's been great having you on, and we're going to, you know, this broadcast will be turned into a CD, and, you know, we'll make sure that we can figure out how we'll market that and get that out. And, again, thank you for your time. Thank you for, you know, spending the morning with me, and take care.
All right. Thank you, brother. I'll talk to you a little later.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.